To the Origin Z Retcon podcast. Please note, this podcast may contain explicit language and spoilers. Keep your hands inside the podcast at all times, your seat in an upright position, and your secret identity secret. And now, here are your hosts, Ian and James.
Welcome, true believers, to episode 15 of Origin Z Retcon Podcast, as we delve deep once again into a world of fantastic. I'm James.
And I'm Ian.
And this time, we've had all the waiting done and over with. The Wolverine has come out to theaters for the world to enjoy. If for some reason you haven't seen this movie yet, I'm not sure exactly what is wrong with you, but I'm sure it involves some kind of medical or psychological impairment that requires immediate attention. We've got to see the origin story back in 2009, and we're reminded how badass and awesome Wolverine was with his small little cameo in First Class in 2011. But now it's time to take us back to that fateful day in September of 1982.
You know, James, you've probably just confused the ever-loving shit out of everyone by going 1982, and they're like, what happened in 1982?
In 1982, Volume 1, Issue 1 of Wolverine was released. Of course, this wasn't the first appearance of Wolverine, but this is the first time that he gets his first full story in volume released in a four-part volume. And it was pretty much the basis for this movie itself.
Yeah, I mean, this is, there was a lot of hype for this movie, James, and because the particular type of story, when they said that they were going to take the Japanese tales, or the samurai story, as some way to frickin' call it, there was a lot of people who were nervous, including me, and I think you were slightly nervous as well, and there was a lot of people out there who were like, oh, Wolverine going to Japan, so you're playing to the Asian market because they're becoming the largest cinema, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, well, yeah, I can see where people were arguing about that. And for the hype itself, I didn't try to build myself up so much for it because, as everyone knows that listens to the podcast, I was shattered during Iron Man 3. Iron Man 3 was a great movie, but I was built up for a different kind of story. So in this one, they have the whole Asian theme going. They kind of throw in some name dropping, but don't really show too much unless you did read the comic. And the biggest thing that they had with this was a huge budget, because a lot of it was actually shot outside of America. A lot of it was shot actually in Japan, in some other remote places. And the whole story census behind it was slightly different than what the comic was giving, such as Wolverine giving up his powers.
Yeah, and the for those who are like interested in just like brief numbers around the budget, like this was 120 bars in terms of like what it actually just cost to rocket. That was a rough estimate. And what's funny is, James, when you're looking at this, I don't see 120 million on the screen.
Yeah, I really feel that a lot of that budget either went to actors, which they had some named actors, but the rest of it had to go to just being off-site and getting permits and things like that for shooting in Japan. Some of the places that they shot in Japan are very, very heritage-like, where I'm sure the permit cost to shoot in a certain place was very expensive. I think the biggest things you see with special effects would be actually done green-screened, like the bullet train fight and the Yoshida Tower and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, this movie is done pretty well, sort of straight out the box. And I think a lot of people were expecting it to. I mean, look, it's a July flick, so it's right in the middle of the summer or the tail end of the summer, depending on what way you want to look at it, depending on where you are on the globe. I mean, the opening weekend, like Wolverine grossing just over 53 million in North America, 86 million around the world, and like coming home for a total of 150 million. I mean, bam, there's the budget back, and maybe it's part of the marketing or the additional sort of heavy marketing that they pushed in the last sort of 2-3 weeks.
Yeah, and so they, with opening weekend, they kind of broke a little bit above even. And this had a lot of people concerned for if, like, Wolverine was becoming stale or getting tired of seeing Wolverine. And I can't really say that it's that because, at least here in the Americas, a lot of people are starting to vacation end of July and in August. So I can understand not immediately wanting to go to the box office. And a good curve to show this is, I mean, during the weekdays, over Monday and Tuesday, it's grossed 5 million each day. So I think it's going to have a couple decent weekends where it'll be number one, maybe one or two more weekends, and still get that big boosting, you know, money back from making the movie, as opposed to just being a fizzled flick, because it was an amazing movie.
I mean, let's just throw some additional stats in here, and this is just for the guys who want to play along with, like, think of it as top trumps or trading cards for, like, comic book style movies. This is actually the sixth movie this character has actually appeared in.
Yeah.
Right, so that's it. That's the first, like, stat we want to throw in this, okay? And the second stat that you need to throw in for this is that this is a movie that, even on its opening, has done more than Origins, and I'm pretty sure this has done more than X-Men 2 and X-Men 3.
Yeah, it did more than X-Men 3. Origins actually had a pretty decent weekend. I think it's about on par with it at this time. But as for the franchise ranking, right now, it's still ranked sixth in overall grossing.
Yeah.
Obviously, because it has, it's only the opening weekend still considerably. So it still has a large margin to go. I mean, it has a lot of things going for it. And I think those upcoming weekends will help boost that, and you'll see almost the same reaction as the opening weekend. Now, one thing I do want to poke and prod at is it made $4 million from Thursday night showings. This is including the showings before midnight.
Really?
So that midnight showing at 12 is not included in that $4 million. From what I read, or how it's calculated on Box Office Mojo, that's what they said, because 12:01 is considered Friday opening weekend. So $4 million alone from that, and I personally saw it at 8 o'clock, and it was in a very small theater, maybe about 150 seats, and it wasn't even packed. The reason for that, I mean, a lot of movies are doing this now, where they're doing not just that midnight showing that you're looking forward to at midnight, but they're doing a showing before that.
Yeah, the 10 o'clock showings or something like that.
Yeah, 10 o'clock. Yeah, not 8 o'clock. I'm sorry. I didn't see it at 8. That's all at 10. I'm sorry. Because I actually got there early on Thursday in case it was going to be packed. But there was no kind of publicity or marketing, or in any way that you saw that it had a 10 o'clock showing was if you went and got tickets online.
Or listings.
And it's a little frustrating because that really hurts the impression of the movie for anyone that goes to it, because I was immensely surprised that a theater wasn't even half full for this at 10 o'clock. But then again, they didn't really have anything special.
See, I wonder if that's the theaters actually doing that as opposed to the movie companies themselves.
It's actually based on a communication contract with the theaters and publishing team. Production company. So Fox and like AMC or Fox and Cinemark, they're all individual contracted. So that's what was the whole problem with Iron Man 3 might not have even been released opening weekend because Disney.
Disney.
Yeah, Disney and AMC theaters were having this huge argument, and then automatically like Cinemark jumped in there saying, hey, we want more percentage of it too. You're not going to take all this money from us. So all those are really based up on, I guess, marketing projections from the theater that then negotiates. But it's still really it's number one for the weekend, which is good. It made surprisingly a lot more, for the low amount that it did bring in, it made about four times as much as second place. So it still shows that it's a strong movie. It was just not a strong weekend for the box office.
Yeah, and I think this weekend in the US or North America, they're actually expecting it to still do decent numbers. But on this side of the pond, I don't think that's going to happen because we have Red 2 opening up and a Bruce Willis movie with Dame Helen Mirren and John Malkovich. Red 1 in the theaters over here did pretty well. And this movie coming out where it's Bruce Willis, who's a little bit more normalized in terms of like his audience appeal on this side of the water, I think that's going to maybe hurt the Wolverine numbers, because there's a couple of guys I work with and they haven't seen the Wolverine yet. And they seen that Red 2 was opening this weekend, they're like, yeah, I might skip the Wolverine this weekend instead. I might go watch Red 2 instead. I'm like, wow.
Yeah, it's going to be a little bit rough for it, and at least in the UK. I think Red 2 is already out in Japan. Japan actually had a good following for the movie. It's actually ranked fifth for how much it made in Japan for movies this year. So it had a big following with that.
I'd say this movie isn't going to do particularly well in China, given how Japanese orientated it is. I think this movie is probably one of those that's... Yeah, they can forget about that. But they've got much bigger problems at the moment in China with loads of the movie companies not getting paid.
Yeah. Now, a large part being part of the budget in the hype, there was a lot of internet rumors about the movie being about 50% or more in subtitle. And that very well may have hurt the movie greatly because there's only maybe a total of 5 minutes that's subtitled.
See, but I think that only bothers really, North American audiences more than European audiences.
Exactly. Yeah, that's exactly what I was more so pointing at. Because the overseas number, it made more overseas than it did here in America, which is, it's usually close to or if not more in America. But Americans, for some reason, are stuck up and hate subtitles.
You're making us read!
They just can't keep up with it, maybe. I don't know. A lot of dumb Americans, I guess. But either way,
the hype for the
movie, yeah, the hype for the movie was good. The trailers, I think, were pretty good. The only problem that I see with the trailers was that they were very comic book oriented, as opposed to this is going to be a summer action movie, go see it. So I think that lost a lot of weight. With it being called The Wolverine, everyday moviegoers may recognize the Wolverine or Logan, but they don't immediately connect it to X-Men, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what it is. There seems to be this really weird prevailing thing at the moment with American writers where they're like, the Wolverine, and then, what was it, the dude who did the Da Vinci Code, Dan Brown, in his recent book Inferno, where he refers to Michelangelo's David as the David. Yeah. And I just kind of looked at that and went, oh, for fuck's sake, what? Just drop the. It's just Wolverine, right. For God's sake. He doesn't rock up in the place and go, I'm the Wolverine, bub.
Yeah. Well, in the comic, he says, I'm Wolverine.
Yeah, he doesn't go, I am the Wolverine.
The Wolverine, exactly. Yeah. He's not an actual Wolverine.
Mr. Logan, sir, you've dropped your prepositions. I think you need to correct that. You got a problem, bub. Snicked.
Exactly. So the plot of the movie itself, it was pretty comic-oriented. It stayed pretty close as much as it could while staying a modern time-set movie. The whole plot is that Wolverine goes to Japan based on the dying wish of someone that he interacted with in World War II. So the plot itself is really built on just a small relation of a by chance meeting. It doesn't really expand on Wolverine's and Yoshida's relationship or why he would have any relationship with them. So its take at the beginning and why they're meeting up is slightly different from the comic. And a lot of people were okay with that. Myself, I was okay with that because it still made
okay with it too. Yeah.
So beyond that, it goes to a point where it splits the acknowledgement of who he's associated with between the grandfather or in the father, and expands from there. So in the comic, Logan or Wolverine is friends with Shinjin, which is Mariko's father, as opposed to being friends with her grandfather, which is Haruhiko Yoshida, which is the one dying in Summoned Wolverine. And they touch a little bit on the contracts of Shinjin being not a nice guy, making Mariko do what he says and her wanting to honor her family and her father. And based on that, it expands on what her grandfather is doing with the company after he passes and so on. And it kind of builds up on that story and throws in a whole bunch of scenes from the comics.
And also the whole thing with tying in X-Men Last Stand as well, with Famke Janssen's Jean Grey character, those sort of almost dream sequences, which is actually sort of with his own guilt and his own conscience. I mean, it was such a nice thing to do. Like, again, I didn't really feel that the fact that they didn't stray miles away from the story and honored it quite well. I mean, one of the things I think you would agree with is that this actually honored the origin story quite well. I know that you had mixed feelings about the Extremis story for Iron Man 3, and I think this actually pays better homage to its origin than Iron Man 3 did to the original Extremis story.
Yeah, so to give you a little bit of a timeline to get a better understanding of what happens, X-Men Origins takes place in 1981. X-Men, X2, and Last Stand take place in about the early 2000s. The Wolverine takes place 8 years after at Last Stand, and then 2 years after that, when he's in, if you stayed for during the credits, you'd see he's in an airport. That's when Days of Future Past takes place. It's 2 years after The Wolverine, which is 10 years after Last Stand. And we're supposed to gain the assumption that this is 2023 at this point. That's for Days of Future Past. So Wolverine itself, the Wolverine movie, should take place in actually 2013, modern time, like what they said. Or actually, no, I misspoke. Last Stand would take place in 2013. The Wolverine takes place in 2021. Sorry about that.
Yeah, no, it's I like the way that they weren't afraid to dive into timelines with the other ones as well. And again, it'd be very easy for them to keep this extremely tight, and to not be as loose as they are, like, with this in a lot of respects. Like, you know what I mean, by in terms of they don't mind playing with this huge time frame, because I think it gives a lot to the story as well. It gives a lot of gravitas to the problems that Wolverine actually faces in this story, with his whole thing of and I think it's very much like the Highlander story, you know, living for so long and watching so many people you love die and pass before you. In fact, it reminds me an awful lot of the Highlander Endgame movie with Christopher Lambert and Adrian Paul, where Connor McLeod's character is actually at the point where he's just tired of being an immortal, and then it asks for his head to be taken so he can just pass on, and he doesn't want to live his life anymore because he's tired of watching people he loved die. And I think this sort of shows that as well, where Wolverine has been around a long time, and it's actually shown in that opening meeting between Wolverine and Yoshida in Japan, where Yoshida says to him, "You haven't changed a bit."
Yeah, exactly. And he tries to start convincing him that it's time where you can let go, and Yoshida's not ready to go, but...
And you see it in Wolverine's own dream sequences as well, where Jean is saying to him, "Come to me. It's okay to give up and come to where I am," which obviously isn't Jean doing it. Well, we don't know actually, because Jean is a power. Like, it's hard to know what they're hinting at.
That's the whole
thing.
Is like, she could have left part of her memory in his mind, and there's a lot of speculation with that. If it's actually part of her consciousness, or if it's actually her, the Phoenix, trying to somewhat get revenge.
Or her remnants of her psionic energy around the place. I mean, I'm glad that they didn't actually decide to focus in that and left that for a nerd discussion for the rest of us.
Yeah, exactly. So as for the directing take, the director on this was James Mangold. And he's done other movies that weren't actually up to the, you know, the superhero type of movie. I mean, he's done dramas and westerns and documentaries. Like, he's did 310 to Yuma, he's directed in. He's worked on the production team for a couple of the new series out, the main one being, like, Vegas. So he's really known for those kind of dramatic western movies or TV shows. And in this kind of sense, you can see where he might have fit in well, because you get that showdown kind of feeling quite a bit throughout the movie. I mean, that's all what a lot of it is defending honor and showdown and one-on-one battle that Wolverine has to take on.
Yeah, I think he seems very at home. I mean, if anyone has actually seen the 310 to Yuma, it is an incredible movie with Clint Eastwood in it. Like, definitely should be watched. And Mangold just, I always thought he nailed that to the fucking wall in terms of just how nice it was. Night and Day wasn't a great movie, but the action sequences in it were actually very well taken.
Now, speaking about the original 310 to Yuma with Clint Eastwood, Mangold actually directed the new 310 to Yuma with Russell Crowe and Christian Bale. Douglas Roberts, Ben Foster. It's still an outstanding movie, but of course it's not a Clint Eastwood 310 to Yuma, so check them out both out.
Yeah, you definitely should, and that is my bad for getting them confused, and James is very right. This is what happens when I'm like, I'm tired and everything else, and it does happen, and yeah, I fuck up sometimes. It's great. I love it. So anyway, screenplay, dude. It's hard to fucking argue with this screenplay. Like, during the week, like, we had a back and forth between us about the story that they use in Hero and a couple of possible great big giant gaping holes.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple areas that it doesn't... The problem with skipping around with writers and things like that when trying to create a consistent storyline to follow is a bit frustrating. Because it runs into these huge plot holes. So the biggest one that myself picked up on, and then later I went on the internet and tons of people were raging about it, is probably the biggest plot hole there is. And in The Wolverine, Logan recognizes the Yoshida family sword. He recognizes Yoshida. He, even though it's in a dream, he remembers a good part of being captive in World War II outside of Nagasaki. But in general, he remembers everything about Yoshida once he meets him.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is X-Men Origins Wolverine took place in 1981. And inside of X-Men 1 and 2, they never restored his memory. Jean Grey went into his mind attempting to, but she brought back some outlashing memories that she absorbed, not him, and told him where to go for the facility, the Weapon X facility. So no one ever actually restored his memories. They never did it in Last Stand. They never did it in X2. So why does he remember things that happened in 1945? Because that's when it happened, when he was imprisoned, was the bombing of Nagasaki in 1945. So how is he remembering this if he lost his memory completely in 1981?
Yeah, this was one of the things that, like, I originally, when you'd said it to me, I was like, dude, you're just being pedantic for the sake of it. But then I started having a bit of a think about it, and I'm like, I think I'd said to you initially that I could swallow the whole thing of, in the X-Men movies, where Xavier is trying to piece back the parts of the fragments of his mind. But the fact that you get so many clear memories being shown in the movie, it completely blows that theory out of the fucking water. And what I find even more astonishing is, this isn't a movie property that shifted around from movie companies. This was with fucking 20th Century Fox. Someone over there is in charge of this IP and greenlighting movies around this particular IP. You would think, given $120 million and how many other countless millions have been sunk into this fucking IP, along with X-Men, that someone, and I mean that, someone would actually sit there and go, hey, if you look at how the Marvel movies work right now, like Iron Man and the Avengers flicks, and how the continuity of the stories remains in those, and remains very tight, that someone over there would go, hey, people like continuity. And would actually make sure when they're weaving these stories for these additionals, despite who the director is, that they would tie them together nicely instead of leaving them so fucking awkwardly gaping.
Yeah, and I mean, this isn't the first time it happened, obviously. I mean, in First Class, it takes part in 1962, and Xavier has hair. So anyone that's read the comics or anything like that are familiar with Professor Xavier. He's been bald since college, either shaving or just early male baldness. And they had him become crippled in like an accidental shot that ricocheted, as opposed to something that happened at college. Because in theory, he should have been in a wheelchair before First Class.
That's right.
So, I mean, there's all these little things people nitpick about, and it just creates these little holes that people get a little bit frustrated about, because it's things that should be covered up and aren't really taken care of very well. It's one of the biggest things that Bryan Singer said when he's going to do Days of Future Past was he's going to make up for not being there for Last Stand, which is hopefully a good sign. But we're getting a little bit off track of the Wolverine. And we really want to talk about the screenplay itself, which was outstandingly written. Even though it had these little loopholes or little flaws, the story itself is very true to the comic. Almost sometimes too true to the comic where it might alienate everyday moviegoers. It had a lot of references, not necessarily in the story, but visual references, such as like there's a scene where Wolverine is going towards the pretty much the Hand, the Hand's village and hideout, where he's being shot full of arrows and then finally shot with a poisonous one to knock him out, which is very similar to a dream he has, I think, in issue 3 of volume 1, where he's actually having a dream and attacked in. It shows a whole bunch of shurikens in him, and then he gets hit with a poison when it knocks him out. There's a lot of things with Silver Samurai that they allude to. The only thing that they do is they do change around some of the characters. Some of the characters that they change around is Viper. She has a different involvement, not as direct as they had it originally. They also had... Not a lot of people were actually made aware of this, but Harada, the archer from the Hand that is seemingly helping, he's actually supposed to be Silver Samurai. If they expand on that later, that might be something different. They did have the duel between Shinjin and Wolverine, where Shinjin was pretty much messing him up pretty badly until Wolverine finally got the upper hand. So they had a lot of visual references to the comic trying to stay true to it, which sometimes felt jumbled maybe to the everyday moviegoer because they seemed a little bit, not necessarily out of place, but forced, I would say, maybe. But other than that, it was tied together extremely well for James Mangold and I think Mark Bomback were working on it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really have any arguments with it. Like, and that's the thing with this. Before we went to this, and even like last week when we were doing the other podcast, I'd said that I was a little bit worried about this. And you know what? I came out of it going, you know what? There's nothing I really dislike about this. There's nothing in there which I can really bitch, piss, and moan about too much. I actually there wasn't even a sense of relief, like, oh, thank God they didn't fuck that up. It was a case of, I actually just really enjoyed myself. I enjoyed the story, even with a couple of the plot holes in there. And I didn't really think about it when I was watching. It's only when I sort of sat back afterwards, you and me had the chatsies about it, and then a couple of guys I know as well who'd seen it, and we were having the chit-chat about it too. Yeah, I actually really enjoyed it. Like, the story was actually enjoyable. It wasn't like Pacific Rim, switch your brain off, but it certainly wasn't like fucking Sherlock, Elementary, Luther, switch your brain on, must follow all details.
Yeah. So, Mark Bomba and Skank, Scott Frank worked on this together.
Or Frank.
Yeah, and so even though it didn't follow the comics exactly, if you go through the movie and flip through all four issues of Volume 1, you'll be actually be able to almost locate every single event in there, which is, I think, is phenomenal in this day and age of trying to push comics and be as close to the comic as possible. That way you can try and please both sides, the everyday moviegoer and the comic book fan. Because, as everybody knows, Watchmen did that, where they stayed almost dead to the comic. The only thing they really changed was the ending, and it didn't really do well with everyday moviegoers, so it's very hard to find that medium. And I think they did an outstanding job with what they were given to try and fit into, and I think that's how they actually should start going about doing volumes and movies.
Yeah, but it also, I think, gives these kind of movies a bit of a crutch in one respect, that they make them very much comic book movies as opposed to making them movies that are around comic books. And I think if you look at Iron Man, the very first one, and I hate using this as an example, but at the same time I like using it as an example, is that appeals to people who never fucking read a comic in their life. And even like even people who didn't pick up a comic book afterwards, going, I must have a look at these, went to watch Iron Man 2, went to watch Avengers, and liked them for what they were. They were action movies that had comic book characters in there that didn't pander down to comic books.
Exactly. And I mean, beyond that, the only other thing that they can really expand on is, I mean, just being able to keep interest of the everyday moviegoer, because you're always going to get the comic book fans going to come out and see it, no matter how horrible Superman was ever going to be, and how much I don't really like Superman as a comic book hero, I still go see him because I'm a comic book fanatic. The thing that they have to appease, unfortunately, is the everyday moviegoer to keep being able to produce these, because if that everyday moviegoer isn't going to do it and they just start getting called followings, unfortunately, sacrifices have to be made to make that money. And beyond that, I mean, at least you have some actors in the cast that aren't asking for outstanding amounts of money that destroy a budget. Even though Hugh Jackman is now tied into Wolverine forever, he's not the one killing the budget.
Yeah, I mean, the beautiful thing about this, let's just take this cast, okay? This is actually, I think, one of the nicest cast selections ever, because when they went to do this flick, they were not afraid to stick unknowns to Western cinema or to in the mix, and to also keep it as actual local actors, actual Japanese actors, not Asian Americans, but actual Japanese actors, and putting them in there and shooting it in Japan, keeping it local. And it's one of the things that Jackman himself is particularly proud of. I mean, he loves the Wolverine. He doesn't look at it as a noose around his neck and stare. He, like, that's why he, every time they say, will you come back and do this, he's like, fuck yeah.
Yeah, he's really in tune with the character now. He is the look of Wolverine.
But I think he gets the essence of him.
He's very comfortable. Yeah, he's very comfortable with how Wolverine would react in certain situations. And that helps dramatically. He does voice acting work as Wolverine. He does the cameos. He does the movies. He does the marketing things. And he just loves playing the character, which is really, really good when you find someone that can actually do that and pull it off. And isn't going to kill a franchise. I mean, he's very up there with Johnny Depp of being able to love the characters that he plays. And it's not the fact that he's asking for a lot of money. It's just for some reason production studios feel they're going to reject it, so they throw a shit ton at him. But other than Hugh Jackman, I mean, a lot of these people are semi-no name.
Actually, the only one I recognized was Brian T, because he was in Fast and Furious Tokyo Drift.
Oh. Well, they had Hiroyuki Sanada. He was in Rush Hour 3.
That's right.
He was in The Last Samurai. He was in The Twilight Samurai. He was in... he was on a couple episodes of Lost. He's also going to be in the movie coming up, unfortunately, with Keanu Reeves, 47 Ronin, which I'm looking very forward to. And it's like, I guess it can't be as bad as Tom Cruise playing in Last Samurai. But it's something that I'm really looking into. He's really big into the feudal era movies, Japanese movies. He's an outstanding actor. He's done quite a few Japanese films and TV series. Beyond that, that's pretty much the two biggest names is those two. Everyone else is rather low-key or a new face, which I think is great because I don't like, I don't mind it most of the time, but I don't like when they bring someone that's well-known and try to force them into this role because they're a big name. Like, they either have to have a passion for that character or some kind of reason to want me to have them be there. Some of the unknowns was Tao Okimoto. She's a little bit of an unknown. She actually played Mariko.
I actually liked the way that character was played by her. The change in her character was very subtle all the way through it. It didn't all of a sudden go from one extreme to the other, and I thought it was very well played. And this is the thing I kind of like about it enough, and this is a really horrible sweeping generalization, but I like an awful lot of the Asian actresses and just the way they actually have done things over the years in Hollywood movies. And then when you see sort of American actresses do it, they don't really... I don't think they give as much to their characters in some respects. I know that sounds like a horrible sweeping generalization. It's not meant to be derogatory. It's not meant to be otherwise. It's just when you see these roles and they're done by people who are you've never heard of or seen in your Western movies, and they just blow you away. I mean, it reminds me of that lady did like Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon.
Yeah, and I mean, it's just the whole thing is that they bring in these low key actors, even the actress that played Viper.
Dude, she was fucking terrible.
I'm gonna butcher her name.
Svetlana Kodchenkova.
Yeah. Apparently she's a really big Russian actress. Like, she's actually famous for Russian movies, indie movies, things like that. But she's never really had any large Western civilization movies put out, such as like anything like on the scale of Wolverine. So I think the closest thing she was ever in American wise was Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, which was a
Scandinavian movie.
Yeah, and it wasn't really low budget, but it just doesn't expand as far as it could have.
What am I thinking? I'm thinking of the girl with the dragon tattoo. What the fuck? It's Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy is the movie with Gary Oldman and a couple others. It's very, very British orientated.
Gary Oldman, Mark Strong.
Yeah.
Colin Firth.
Yes.
But yeah, it was a pretty popular movie. It came out a couple years ago, and it won a couple awards, but unfortunately, the role that she played in it wasn't one of the headlining actresses. So even though that she... Oh, it actually had Cumberbatch in it.
That's right, yeah. It had Sherlock or John... fuck, I can never remember his character from Star Trek. Khan.
Benedict Cumberbatch.
Yeah, Cumber and his Cumber bitches.
Yeah, but... it's nice to see that we're able to get these talented actors and actresses trying to usher in some new ones that are no names and being able to put them into that superhero role. Because unfortunately, a lot of these people are going to get almost forced into that typecasting. But if it's something like a key role for someone like Mariko or Viper, they're key in that movie, but it's not going to stick with them and ruin their acting career.
Oh, but I'm going to have a bitch now about one thing in this, and this is not a reflection of the actress. I think this is a reflection on the director. Famke Janssen for the movie is nothing more than tits in a nighty, and that kind of fucking bugged me.
I'm perfectly fine with that.
No, but see, you know what, you know, but you know what I mean by just like for, I thought there was a couple of ways they could have dressed that up in terms of that character that always had to be like an in bed scene for, okay, like, hey, I'm a dude and I'm not complaining about that for like just as a person. I'm not a fucking prude or a newfound British Puritan from fucking 2013.
Well, you gotta remember, these are like Wolverine's visions of her, like how he sees her. He sees her as that sexy piece of ass that he misses and loves. I mean, it's not necessarily that. That's how they're portraying Jean Grey constantly. That's how Wolverine sees her in his mind when he relates to her, wants to be with her. He's always waking up peacefully next to her. That's the whole thing, is that she's his serenity, and that's how he feels comfortable. I mean, you got to keep that in mind. I do agree that it should have been... I mean, they couldn't really do any kind of advanced things like her being fully dressed and like being the second voice in his head, because she wasn't this vision he was seeing. It was his subconscious bringing her to light and talking to her in his subconscious. So it's a little bit different. So it didn't really bother me that much, but I can see exactly where you're going with it, where they just kind of dressed her up to look pretty in the movie.
Because I often think with the whole Logan and Jean relationship dynamic, that it's about a hell of a lot more than just like the animal attraction and their sexual relationship with them, that it goes much deeper than that. It's actually like, she is the one person that Wolverine actually fucking cares about in the world, like above everyone else, and then will sacrifice every other relationship, even amongst his like X-Men family, even though he knew he was crossing the line with Scott there, he still like went for it. So I think that's what bugged me about that more than anything else, is that his relationship with her was about much more than that, and the fact that they only wanted to portray that as part of it. To me, again, I'm not trying to be like a member of the newfound British prudes, and yes, I will constantly make a reference to that. Touch my porn, I fucking kill you. But it just felt like it was there to be nothing more than to add some salaciousness to it, and it was needless salaciousness.
In my opinion, I think it's something where they're just trying to express Wolverine's lust for wanting to be with her again. That too, and it does. Then again, in the trailers, they didn't really show her fully in the nightie or anything like that, or nightgown. It just showed her in bed and him stabbed her. So very similar to the scene with Rogue. I can see where the argument is for it, but I really think they more so tried to convey it as, this is how Wolverine envisions her in his mind. Something more, not necessarily seductive, but free-spirited, I would say, with that hippie talk.
Yeah. The other thing we should get into with this, and we're talking about the plot around the cast and the rest of it and how the thing goes, you know, the throwbacks into the comic book, we should definitely sort of nail into the, I know we've sort of touched on like how much it goes around it, but I think there's a couple other really nice ones that are in there, and they didn't take non-fans of the comic book or people who've never fucking read it. They didn't catch them out where they found themselves going, what the fuck is going on here? And they didn't do anything which required a whole heap of back explanation or for people to have to go and do some fucking research on it.
Yeah. The only thing I think that left people a little bit out in the dark was which I loved. I thought it was the best thing in the world, the way that they started the movie, which was Wolverine in the wilderness and finding the wounded bear, because that's exactly how the comic starts. And I thought that was the biggest thing they could nod to the comic book fans to give a really good first impression of even going back to Jose's bar or Josie's bar, hunting down the hunter and then stabbing the arrow through his hand. I thought the whole scene where Logan had to put down the bear and everything, where they conveyed it very emotional for him, that the bear was in pain and everything like that. That's probably the biggest thing that pushed a little bit on everyday moviegoers, is like, what's actually happening? What's going on? Why am I even watching this? But anyone that is familiar with just the first couple pages of the comic connected with it right away.
Yeah, I thought that was played out really, really well. And it reminded me of the... You ever see the scenes in some of the animated movies where he comes up close to the bear? A bear in the animated stuff, and he ends up either calling them Smokey or something like that. I'm thinking in particular of the Wolverine versus Hulk animated movie. That came as the two-part, where it was Hulk versus, and one was Hulk versus Thor, and one was Hulk versus Wolverine. And Hulk versus Wolverine, he comes across a bear and refers to him as Smokey. Or Yogi, I can't remember which.
Yeah. Yogi. Yeah, he calls him Yogi.
Now, the special effects in this. Right, I want to move on to this because this is either, like, regardless of story and everything else, with these movies, it's the one thing that can utterly make or utterly break these movies. Nothing in here, like, actually, no, there is one, I'm going to say it, like, it is this, the fight scene on the train, it did look a little fucking weird.
Well, the fight scene in his train, it did look weird. But the thing is, you have to remember, it's supposed to be simulating a train going 300 miles an hour. I thought they used a lot of clever physics with that, with them jumping up and down, even when he tricked the guy by doing a fake jump and the guy jumps and he gets hit. So I think as for using the surroundings during the bullet train scene, it did look a little bit hokey, but I personally can't say for sure if that's not exactly how it would look if I was fighting on a roof of a bullet train. So it gave a fake feeling because it's not something that you would imagine would happen, really. Especially like stabbing the knives into the train to keep grip and stuff like that. Obviously, Wolverine could probably do it with his claws because he has three, but the guy was doing it with one knife.
I'll tell you what I think has actually colored my view for this, for the bullet train thing, and it's only when I'm thinking about it more. Pacific Rim. If you're going to do action on a really big and totally off-the-wall fucking scale, do it so. Do it to the best fucking thing you can do possibly. Do it so you leave nothing on the field whatsoever. And it's just like, wow, you just blew your load all over the fucking screen and it's all over me and I'm messed up. And that was epic. And I don't think for that, I was looking at it going, it looks a little fucking hokey. And then even when I'm thinking about, well, it's on a bullet train, but I'm still like, yeah, I know, but...
Yeah, I kind of tuned out. When I was watching it, I kind of just tuned out, like, the surroundings and actually being on a bullet train. When I was focusing on the fighting scene, as I mentioned, I was more so focusing on, like, the physics and the things that they did to interact with the surroundings as opposed to it actually being fought on a bullet train. I mean, at least they didn't have them standing upright fighting or something like that. So I can get exactly where they kind of wasted special effects. Not necessarily wasted special effects, but missed an opportunity to make that feel more immersive.
Yeah, I mean, it's... The problem putting fight scenes on trains is that there's so many great examples of fight scenes on trains. Some that are done wonderfully simple. A great example of that is the Richard Chamberlain King Solomon's Mines, for example.
Oh, yeah, that. I was going to say Skyfall.
Actually, that was the next one to modern takes like Skyfall, which I think was really quite neat. And even if I go again, think about the Captain America movie. The fight scene where they're trying to get on the train and the scenes of getting onto the train, that looked absolutely shit hot.
Yeah.
And I mean, if it's one of those things where
that's
I think
the only...
No, no. It's even if I think back to which is the Pierce Brosnan Bond movie with the train.
Another Day to Die.
Not Die Another Day. It's the very first one he did. Has Famke Janssen in it as well, actually. Nah, I can't remember. But anyway, if you know what the answer is and we don't get it before the end of the podcast, send us a tweet or send us an email. Moving on. But the train thing, like, if you're going to do something on a train, make it the best ever, because there's so many amazing sequences have been done on trains. Even the Lone Ranger movie, which is total dog shit.
I kind of liked it, because it was like, when I watched the Lone Ranger, I envisioned the old TV show and just put it in that whole B-rating kind of setting, and then at that point, it was awesome.
But the train sequence in that is really good. I can't fault it.
Well, they had double trains. I didn't know what it meant.
I thought it was like spit roasting. No, I'm just kidding. Jeez, and I've just totally just ramped it up. And we're usually explicit. I've just moved it into almost pornographic there. But so, yeah, and then the special effects. There's a couple of scenes in this actually I quite liked. I liked the Silver Samurai. There are some people out there who fucking bitched about it and were like, I can't fucking believe that looked like dog shit. I didn't think that. Well, I kind of liked it.
I liked it because I'm hoping that that's like, you know, this whole feeling of a prototype Silver Samurai. Like, that's just this temporary Silver Samurai. It's just what it was used in that a real Silver Samurai, like in the comics and stuff like that, will be something later in time. And that's what I took from it, was that Silver Samurai was like their Mark One building of like an entire exosuit plus life support. So obviously it looked clunky. It looked weird. The heated adamantium was plausible because it's very hard to melt out adamantium, but you can heat it just like you can heat regular metal, but it's not going to melt. Absolutely makes it easier to cut through other same metal consistencies. So the only thing I can say about the bullet train again was like the train sequence. Like, we've seen really good train sequences. The thing is, the only thing that I give it a little bit leeway is we've never really seen a good bullet train fight sequence. I mean, a train is going 60 to 100 and some miles an hour. A bullet train is going 320 to 360. So there's not much that you can really logically expand on. It could have been better. It could have felt better. As for some of the greater things that I thought that were special effects was the scenery that they use, the gardens, the Hand Citadel Castle. Yes. A lot of that was done with CG and some on set. And I think they portray that extremely well for the Yoshida clan, almost directly out of the comics.
Yeah.
It looked really great. It felt authentic, not animated or CG. And it really started to give you an immersive feel. The biggest negative to me from being not expanding on their special effects was pretty much IMAX. I was disappointed that this X-Men film was not in IMAX again. I mean, it's something that gives you a little bit more depth to enjoy such hard work that they put into scenes like that. Where they could get higher resolutions for the CG and let people be able to connect to them a lot better.
Do you know what the one thing that disappointed me most was? The fucking laziness of the 3D. And I am going to fucking piss and moan about this like crazy. This movie should never have been dropped out in 3D. There is absolutely nothing there to make this worth watching in 3D. This doesn't even have like G.I. Joe Retaliation, ninjas on fucking wires.
Exactly. Like, that's what I was worried about, because I did see it in 3D, and I wasn't sure what I was looking at if it was in 3D or not.
So, I was bitterly disappointed, and I couldn't believe I coughed up extra cash. This is what this reminds me of. This reminds me of going to watch Wrath of the Titans or Clash of the Titans and coming out and going, what the fuck did I just part with extra money for?
Yeah, because I'm trying to think of any kind of scene specifically where I noticed 3D, and I didn't. Like, the movie itself could have definitely been just all 2D. I would have rather seen the budget money go into producing it in IMAX as opposed to 3D. There really was not a single thing that would need the depth 3D would give.
Yeah, you know what? I just want to like put this on the table. Look, movie company peoples, if you listen to this fucking podcast or anyone who is knows anyone who works in these movie companies, if you're gonna fucking do a 3D movie, at least put one goddamn scene in there that gives you a payoff for it. If the assholes who made G.I. Joe Retaliation could just make a movie where they had that one cool ninjas on a zipline scene that just totally made paying that extra couple of bucks worth it in every way, shape, and form, what the fuck is your problem? Just do it. They could have even done it for that scene where they're firing all the arrows into his back.
Well, they did do it. It was just very subtle.
It's dog shit.
The only time that you really noticed it was when he stepped up to shoot the poison arrow into his back.
Yes.
When they had all of it stringing to him where he was still trying to push forward, you could see the 3D a little bit, but it really wasn't feeling 3D. It was very two-dimensional scene, unfortunately. It was almost to the point where they could have possibly been showing me the 2D version by accident and I wouldn't have noticed it.
And what's funny is there was points in the movie where at various times I took off my Robert Downey Jr. 3D type glasses, you know, the Iron Man ones, the black and the golden side, looked like his shades. I took it off various times, and you know what? No difference in the fucking movie.
Yeah, I don't really know what they were thinking about, like, trying to push that in 3D. I mean, there's... Unfortunately, with a superhero like Wolverine, it's very up
you
close
don't
and personal.
Need 3D, because so it you, is, like, in the mix. You're right up there at the edge of his claws.
The only thing I want to see in 3D that would probably look terrible on screen is if you gave me a point of view look where he's fighting somebody and you can see his fist and claws swiping at him or something.
Oh, that would but be then, deadly, first like person. Shit. I would actually quite like to see a scene in a Wolverine movie where it switches to first person of him slicing
Doom.
Through people.
Like, did you ever see the movie Doom?
Yeah, I like that.
I thought it looked like retarded.
Oh, come on.
Stupid.
You can't have a Doom movie and not fucking expect that to be in there. Your
well,
entire
I expected
experience.
It to be in there, but they did it with 3D and it looked stupid as shit. And then again, that was very early stages, so whatever.
Yeah. Dude, what the fuck were you expecting?
I think as for special effects and things like that, the movie really didn't require a lot. The Silver Samurai, some of the sceneries, I thought the special effects for the bombing of Nagasaki was...
That looked fucking insane.
Really
and I mean, actually, the sequence when the bomb goes off and they're in the underground bunker and he has the metal shield over Yoshida on the ground and then he pulls back and you see just how fucked up he is and his body healing. That looked awesome. I actually was pretty... But at the same time, I was like, I'm expecting him to go, I loved you, Anakin, like you were my brother.
Yeah, my respect to anyone, family or friends that was ever involved in the Nagasaki or Hiroshima bombings, especially with World Peace Day coming up on August 6th. But it was definitely something that was made memorable in the movie, where it actually showed the impact of what happened and how he told him he didn't want to come up yet because of the radiation, where Wolverine just peeked out and looked at shock and awe of the devastation that happened.
It kind of reminds me of that scene, and if anyone has been following the new TV series Under the Dome, where they actually launched the missile at the dome, and then the other side of the dome just looks like a fucking nuclear wasteland.
Oh, yeah, when they launched the Moab at it.
Yeah.
But as for any other special effects, I mean, the only thing that they really needed for was for mutant reasons.
Her skin thing fucking bugged me.
Yeah. Really, you didn't like her peeling the skin?
Actually, I'll tell you what the thing is, right? Here's my beef with this. Her skin thing, me having a beef with that, is a minor part of it. I don't get what the fuck the point was of her character, apart from being used as a piece of misdirection. It's a pointless character. All she is a piece of misdirection. She didn't even have to be a mutant.
Well, she's in the original comic, Viper.
I know, but if you think about the storyline, okay, original comic aside, she didn't actually need to be a mutant for that, for the movie.
Technically, yeah. She didn't have to.
It's a bioengineering device she puts inside Wolverine. She could have been a human.
Yeah, but as I was mentioning it, I'm sure it was more so just a nod to her as she is part of the Wolverine Volume 1. She actually, at one point, becomes a love interest of Wolverine. As fucked up as that is, but that's later on.
But I think they could have avoided it for this movie.
I agree, because her part in the comic is very backstage-ish. She's more so involved with the Hand in the Yoshida clan as opposed to actually being involved with, like, Silver Samurai. But as for the at least Volume 1 and having her in this movie, she necessarily wasn't needed. I don't feel having her in it hurt it any, though.
I just think it was because you don't have the wider context of her character, right? And that's the thing. The wider context of her character is not shown here. There's no reference to it. You're never going to see her character again in any of the movies because the way they disposed of her, they could have just left her human. And it would have made far more of an impact that she... There's nothing wrong with changing and making that reference. I mean, I think a really good example of this is, again, I'm going to play into the Iron Man 3 card, the Mandarin. The Mandarin was not an Asian dude, not a dude of green skin, and even the Mandarin in the movie was a misdirection, and you know what? That worked for that.
Yeah, exactly. Well, they wrote it differently to involve the Mandarin. So, I mean, as you were mentioning, it is a situation where she could have been left out almost completely. I still, as I mentioned, I don't feel that it hurt. I think it expanded a little bit more on the Hand organization, even though they never named it, just named it Clan Yoshida, which is in fact the Hand. There's a lot of things they didn't expand on, though. I mean, they didn't expand on Shinjin being a Yakuza lord. He had the Yakuza after his grandfather, but it was never said that he was part of the Yakuza. He never said he was really like a crime lord or anything like that, just that he wanted to use his father's company in a different way. So, I mean, granted, there's a lot of things they could have expanded on. They could have left Viper out of it all completely and been completely fine. It's unfortunate they didn't expand on Yukio's relationship with Wolverine, because that's part of the frustration that actually happens between Mariko and Yukio, is their infatuation with Wolverine.
Yes.
Specifically after Mariko says she can't be with him. But overall, I think the character development back with the special effects was kept at the right amount where they didn't overdo it. It wasn't Michael Bay'd. They didn't have unnecessary explosions or special effects when they didn't need it. The Viper skin peeling, it kind of makes you feel why she's even doing that, even though, granted, it shows her falling and stuff like that. It was just something put in there for eye candy.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing you look at, again, I'm not going to harp on this, I'm going to close just on this thought, just around the Viper character, right? Tell me, like, okay, Wolverine's mutant powers, right? That is essential to that story. Tell me exactly what part of her, for this movie, exclude the whole the whole comic book history and the canon type side of things to this, okay? Explain to me what part her mutant powers played in being able to carry her part of the story. They had no relevance whatsoever.
Who's Vipers?
Yeah, in terms of this movie, there's no relevance to her mutant powers for this story.
Well, it gave insight on how they got the poison to immobilize Wolverine. Because in the comic, they just say that it's a poison mixture. In this, they expand that she's providing the poison.
Oh, yeah, I know. But if you look at just the story where, again, go back to the bio implant inside the guy.
Yeah.
Couldn't she just be an extremely smart biochemist?
Yeah, exactly.
Didn't have to be a mutant to carry the story.
To be honest, because I didn't read anything before I saw the movie. I didn't want to be misled by anything or any of the hype. So I tried to read as little as possible. When she dropped the thing into his mouth when he was sleeping, I honestly thought it was something that was living, not biomechanical.
Maybe it's like a Neo where the little bug gets put on the stomach. Or maybe it's like in Fallen Skies where Karen kisses the dude and infects him.
Some heavy theory crafting there, bro.
I know. It was, you know what? I'm powered by Bundaberg root beer this evening, so anything is possible.
But, yeah, I can see where she could be dropped. I mean, I don't feel it. I mean, no harm, no foul, I guess.
For once, you're being super forgiving.
I can see where you can get frustrated with it because she wasn't a primary part in the comics. She did exist, but she didn't have any kind of major turning point. They brought her into it a lot differently than what they originally thought, where like she's actually working with the grandfather instead of with Shinjin, where Shinjin is pretty much out of the loop of everything. So they kind of reversed a couple of roles there, and maybe they used her as a band-aid to try and patch things up to connect dots, rather. I don't know.
But you know what? Let's move on, because there is one part of this movie that like we cannot go without talking about, and quite simply it is the post-credits scenes on this movie, which I have to say, when I went to watch it, myself, my other half Kate, and maybe one or two other people were the only ones who were left in the cinema. Everyone else fucked off and didn't realize there was post-credit scenes.
Yeah, about a fourth of the people left when credits started, and everybody's like, where the hell are you going? So, like, the people that got up to leave were convinced to stay by the people who were like, are you a fucking idiot? It's a superhero movie. You don't leave before the credits are done.
Exactly.
And I was not disappointed at all from the post-credits.
You know what? I was gobsmacked. Like, I kind of had an idea they may tie it into Days of Future Past, and then I went, maybe they won't. Maybe they just won't fucking bother. In which case, you know, I'm okay with it. And what's funny is, I didn't even know there was going to be, like, a post-credits piece for this, to be quite honest, because I hadn't really spotted anything online from reading it saying, yo, you know, go and stay at the end. It was just like, I'll take a chance with it. It's a Marvel flick, or a Marvel story flick, not a Marvel flick, because it's owned by 20th Century Fox. And I stayed and watched it, and, you know, seeing Patrick Stewart, like, a.k.a. Wheels Xavier, fucking roll up into that airport, I can't help it. And then just seeing, like, Ian McKellen just as Magneto. And you know what? Whatever about Hugh Jackman being Wolverine, no one else could ever be Magneto apart from Ian McKellen, because he just fucking owns
exactly
that, dude.
Exactly. And the biggest thing I have to recommend to you that I do, if I have my smartphone with me at the end of a movie, I go straight to aftercredits.com and search for the movie. It tells you, the biggest thing about it is it tells you like the release date when it comes out, and it has specific information there where it says, is there something during the credits? Yes. Is there something after the credits? No. That's the biggest thing. Because some movies have something right during the credits, and then something sometimes has something after the credits. So that's a website I live by when going to see any kind of movie nowadays. On top of that, I just love the entire scene where it shows 2 years later, because he's traveling Mariko says they can go anywhere, so I guess he's with Yukio going around the world, probably banging her or whatever, whatever Logan loves to do. He's banged so many mutants, it's fucking retarded. But the whole scene where they say 2 years later, and then like Wolverine can sense him, like he can sense Magneto. I guess he starts to feel those bones becoming stiffened, and then it shows him turn around and he pulls out his claws ready to fight Magneto. And then while he's talking to Magneto, you just see everyone else in the background just stop, and you're like, you get that huge feeling of what happened in the museum when Professor X stopped everybody. And you're like, oh shit, oh shit, oh shit. So excited for like to see Professor X again. And when he just kind of zipped around people rolling around on his little wheelchair, he's got really good at it.
Yeah, wheels is fucking rocking it really fucking badass. You know what, James? It really comes into that time where I think we like to go is let's pick like three highs, three lows each. James, since I've more or less turned the big chair over to you for this show, you know what? You're fucking rocking that out first.
All right, my three. Well, I'll go with lows again. I'll go with lows first because you always want to end on a high note. So the biggest lows for me was the chronological order and association to the Yoshida family was very rocky. They didn't have the time to expand on it. They did their best with showing the flashback to the bombing in Nagasaki. But they just showed his obligation was he wanted to help this little girl that he ended up banging. Like, it gives the feeling that Logan's motivation for everything is to score with a chick. Which very well may be. Like I mentioned, he slept with many, many mutants. That's probably the biggest thing to me is that you're not able to grasp the big connection that he has to the family of why he's even bothering to help, other than him wanting to be good. The second low for me would have to be the association with Silver Samurai. I really think that they should have pushed Shinjin to be Silver Harada to be Silver Samurai as opposed to Yoshida. It gave a good reason of why it was happening, but I think having Harada as Silver Samurai as he is in the comics would be able to tie into him being the illegitimate son of Yoshida, of Shinjin, and also being part of this grander plan with the Hand. It had been able to include the Hand a lot easier. Harada could now lead the Hand with Shinjin dead. But they kind of leave you in the middle of nowhere, the Hand. And then lastly, the third lowest would be the disappointment in 3D. There's plenty of opportunities for really outstanding 3D, but they didn't really capitalize on any of it. And if not, it wasn't needed at all. The money could have definitely went better to better resolution with IMAX.
Yeah. You know, and for me, I just like when I'm thinking about my highs, my highs is I loved the capture of the sort of the Japanese backgrounds and skylines and everything else. Utterly in love with those. I love when people like capture Tokyo and they find another way to make Tokyo look cool because Tokyo already looks fucking cool as it is. My other high with this was I loved the strong female Japanese characters in this. And I love the fact that they actually made them strong as opposed to my problem with Pacific Rim where they made the Japanese female character into nothing more than a love interest after starting her out strong. I loved that. That they kept them strong right the way at the end. Especially the Mariko character, how strong they kept her at the end and they kept making her stronger. And even Rila Fukushima, that they kept her Yukio character very strong as well. And didn't turn into the little lady type deal. So my other my third high point for me for this was the braveness of having so many unknown actors. You know, that really for me was, and be like with such an anticipated movie, being that fucking brave about it. and then not hiding behind Hugh Jackman for the thing either. Again, very brave, very happy with that. My lows, first and foremost, the Viper character being a mutant. Again, I've said this, pointless, didn't need to be in there. Stupid plot device that was unnecessary. Should have been made into being a human.
Hate.
I know, sorry, I can't get over it. The 3D, this is... if X-Men Days of Future Past comes out, I don't give a fuck what they put in 3D. I'm not watching it in 3D because I figured I paid too much here. I'm not getting my money back and I'm not giving them another bump for it. And the third one here for me, I think, has got to be... you know what? Fuck it. I'm going with the whole Jean Grey thing.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Yeah. I don't mean to be a dick, but you know what? But I'm going with that because that fucking annoyed me.
Yeah. Now, my three highs for the movie are pretty up there, probably with just about anybody. The fact that they were able to stay so close to the comic has to be my number one high. Because they were very close. They covered a lot of things. They did some role reassignments, like Harada kind of turned into Yukio's character in the comic, where she's part of the hand, then goes good. They did a couple role reversals and changing around the chronologic order of the comic, but it still worked out. I'm just happy that they threw in so many things, if not dialogue wise but visually, into the movie. It's extremely hard to do that and make it a successful movie for everyday moviegoers. So that's one of the first times that they were able to actually really pull that off as close as they did. The second has to be the cast. They had a lot of, as you mentioned, low-key, no-name actors and actresses that they put confidence in, directed very well, and was able to pull off the characters extremely well. I always love it when they cast locally. It gives you more sense of familiarity with the actual actions of the character. And thirdly would have to be the actual visual expressions, not the special effects, but the visual expressions that they did, such as like scenery, the burial ceremony, the southern country of Japan, the Tokyo and Electric City, just from everything from their customs and being able to express everything, going all the way to the Canadian scenes of out the middle of wilderness kind of small town of hunters and things like that. They touched on a lot of small little detailed things that were in the background that really were able to let you appreciate more of what they put into the movie.
Yeah, it's you know what's funny is we say that we're giving our lows on this, and to be quite fair and honest, like, I don't think our lows are really technical lows. If anything, I'd say they're more like minor gripes. And to be honest, I know I'm reaching. Like, okay, the 3D one, I'm not fucking reaching. I'm not backing down on that. There's not a fucking thing in the world that'll make me back down on that one. But on the other two, I'm actually... If they're like my biggest complaints that I have or lows for me for this movie, you know what? They're doing pretty fucking good, I think.
Yeah, exactly. The movie itself is hard to point any flaws out. The flaws that you're going to find are like those small little plot holes or just things that people will naturally nitpick about. Yeah, it's something that's not right or something that's off about the movie, but it's not impacting the overall movie at all. It's things that you can get past, or, well, the whole memory thing is a little bit that you can't really get past, but it's something that you can overlook and hopefully will be filled in later of why he can remember certain things. Because beyond that, there's no reason to complain about the movie. It was actually extremely well done. I mean, just ratings wise, out of a 10, I would give it probably 7.5, pushing 8. Like, I have a really high fan review of it. It did get some bad reviews, but other than that, I mean, it's outstanding. It was a great movie for what I'm looking for in a comic book movie, where there's a huge compound amount of things associated to the comic, but still being able to build in its own originality, such as moving around the order or adding things or role swapping to keep everyone interested.
Yeah, James, I don't think I could, you know, as a final thought, you know, I can't top that, dude. All I can do is echo it.
Yeah, and if you haven't seen it yet and you let us spoil the entire thing for you, go and see it. As we mentioned, we both don't feel that it's worth seeing in 3D. If you want to risk it, it's like an extra $4 here in the States to go see it in 3D.
Oh, and there's no cool 3D glasses, so you're fucked for that too.
Yeah, there was no special events or 3D glasses. I looked very hard for them.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, and you know what? The one thing I will I'll close out just on that thing is, like, if we did spoil it for you, tough fucking shit. We tell you at the beginning of the show we have spoilers.
Sorry.
That was rough and really harsh, but you know what? Harsh but fair, like the Russian police. Ooh, sore nerve.
Tough.
So you know what? Anyway, guys, gals, peoples, comic book peoples, interwebs, folklations, thanks once again for giving us some of your valuable and precious in-ear time to talk about the Wolverine movie here in the Origin Z Retcon podcast. I've been Ian.
And I'm the Wolverine James.
He is, you know. And this has been Origin Z Retcon. Until next time.
Later.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Origin Z Retcon podcast. You can find us on Twitter at Origin Z Retcon, where you can send us your comments about the show using the hashtag OZRCP. You can also check out our website, www.originzretcon.com, and find us on iTunes, Castroller, and SoundCloud.